It's Ask the Lawyer with Mike Connors. Got questions concerning elder or estate law? Attorney Mike Connors has the answer. He's been recognized as one of New York's top lawyers by New York Magazine and brings nearly 40 years of experience to the table. His office number is 718-238-6500. That's 718-238-6500. Here's Mike Connors.
We are gathered here on hallowed ground, horses raised, heads bowed down. We're gathered here on hallowed ground to sing this old way.
Welcome to Ask the Lawyer with me, Mike Connors. The show is in a couple of different parts. The first part of the show, we talk about estate planning and elder law. The idea behind estate planning is to pass assets from one generation to the next, paying the least amount in taxes we need to pay legally, avoiding going through court, that's avoiding probate, and as far as elder law is concerned, trying to save assets from nursing home bills. And as most of you know, the first part of the show, we have one of the other attorneys with us from the office, and today we have Gladys. You haven't been in here for a long time, Gladys. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so you're just on vacation?
Yes.
So where'd you go on vacation?
Turks and Caicos.
Would you recommend that to the audience?
Most definitely. If you're retired and you have the funds, check out Turks and Caicos.
What was so great about it?
Nice beach, nice people, great food, really everything. Can't say anything bad. Okay, so we had a question come in. Both my parents are in their early 80s. My mom was admitted into a nursing home, and we transferred their assets to our father to get my mom on Medicaid. Now our father needs a nursing home as well. Is there any way to protect their assets?
Well, there's certain things we can do. A lot depends on how much we do have in assets. And, of course, one of the first things we want to do is to see if there are any exempt transfers. So, in other words, if, let's say, their residence, if they have a child living in their residence for two or more years, that's an exempt transfer. So we can put that property in a trust and protect it from the medical bills if we have a child living in the house for two or more years. Also, if we have a brother or sister living in the same property, and when I say house, it could be a condo or co-op. I'm just in the habit of saying house because that's 90% of what we do. But if we have a sibling, a brother or sister who lives in the same house with the parent for one or more years, and that sibling has any kind of ownership interest at all in the property, we can also transfer it into a trust or maybe to that sibling and work out a deal later. So that's the first thing we do. Then we look to see if there are any disabled children. Because transfers to a disabled child are exempt from Medicaid from the look-back period. So let's just say, in our example here, we do not have a disabled child. We don't have anybody else living in the residence with the parents. So I'm going to make it a simple thing. Let's say we've got about $500,000 in assets and there's no real estate. And we don't have any, well, let me, we have 500,000 assets, maybe $100,000 in IRA money. So what would we do? Both parents are in a nursing home. There are no disabled children. There's no residence to switch over. And obviously we don't have a spouse in the community. Both spouses are going to a nursing home. Everything's lost, right? No. We have to figure out which spouse we want to apply for Medicaid for. So that depends on basically income. You know, the spouse with the higher income, we might want to, you know, put the assets in the spouse with the higher income. And sometimes this gets a little touchy, what maybe possibly the shorter life expectancy, but let's just say their life expectancy is the same. So we have a spouse with, let's say, $5,000 a month income. Husband, let's say, has $5,000 a month income. Wife has $2,000 a month income. So we're going to put all the assets in the husband's name for now. Wife will get Medicaid. Husband does a spouse refusal. Wife gets Medicaid. So the first couple gets Medicaid. The husband's got $500,000 left. Now, there's certain gifts we can make, but let's say in this example where the husband has $5,000 a month income, and let's say the nursing home bill is about $15,000 a month, we then figure out what gifts we can make, assuming they're children, what gifts we can make to the children. Again, the children are not disabled. So let's say if we have roughly $500,000, we can give maybe $250,000 we give away to the children. So that would cause a penalty for Medicaid for roughly 20 months. We have $250,000 left, which would pay for the 20 months. And remember, we got $5,000 worth of income. We have $10,000 a month. Roughly, we have $10,000 a month coming in, so we can pay for the 20 months without a major problem. The parent then, both parents could keep $40,000 total on Medicaid. So that's basically what we'd do. We'd save about $300,000 out of the $500,000. Now, if the parents had a house and a trust that was in, you know, the trust for more than 5 years, we can take their cash assets and put it into the house. In other words, give it a new roof. Give it a, you know, fix up everything that's wrong with the house, because you can spend your money however you want. And of course, this is one of the things we do too. We could buy a car, and sake of argument, let's say we buy a car for, you know, $40,000-$50,000. Well, that's a good way to save money. And you might say, well, wait a minute. Well, if you're going to a nursing home, why do you need a car? Well, because one of the children could drive the car around, and basically the car is an exempt resource. So we could spend, let's say, $40,000-$50,000 on a car. We could prepay the two funerals of the two parents. That could be another $30,000. We can maybe prepay a funeral. Let's say they have a single child. We prepay the funeral of the single child, another $10,000-$15,000. You know, we can buy things. Now, I'm not crazy about buying jewelry. Some people do it. I don't like buying jewelry because it has a tendency to disappear and start fights. We could buy jewelry. And certainly if the parents are going to a nursing home, they wanted a better radio, the Bose radio, TV set to keep in their room, we would certainly spend money on that. We can spend money however we want. And that's what we would do. And it's great when you have your house in a trust for more than 5 years. Because if you own a house, you can put almost anything in your house. You can pay your real estate taxes for a year in advance. And literally, it would be very easy to save $100,000 or spend $150,000 between that, the car and the funeral bills. We could probably spend $200,000. So in that case, if we spent $200,000, we had $300,000 left, we could give away $150,000. That would cause a penalty for about 10 months for nursing home care, 11 months for nursing home care. But we still have got, you know, $150,000 left, which that and the $5,000 coming a month would, you know, pay for those, pay for those 15 months. So there's always something you can do. And even this is a pretty bad case, we still can do a lot of things. And of course, one of the things we need to have ahead of time is a good power of attorney, where both parents signed a power of attorney to each other and or their children, and especially in this case, also their children, so the children can operate under the circumstances that we were just dealt. And the point I'd like to remember, no matter what, we can always do something as long as the person's competent or we have a good power of attorney. And that's where planning comes into play. We need a good power of attorney to be able to do this stuff. And by a good power of attorney, I'm not talking about the power of attorney you're going to get printed off the internet. I'm not talking about the power of attorney you're going to get in some of those kits that people sell you, which those kits, again, you could read it three times over and not understand any of it because it's contradictory. But if you have a good power of attorney drafted by an attorney who knows what he or she is doing in reference to elder law and estate planning, where we try to cover everything, including making gifts to be eligible for Medicaid. Let's say there was a single person. We had $300,000 in assets to go in a nursing home. Social worker says, oh, you got to give the whole $300,000 to us, and believe me, I've heard it, because this is a five-year look-back period. No, you can do things. You can buy that car we talked about. We can prepay for the funeral. So let's say They have $300,000. We spent $100,000. We have $200,000 left. Basically, we give about $100,000 away to the children legally, and it's according to a formula. We use the $100,000 plus the income to pay, and you give away for each $13,000 and change. Give away, you have to pay for 1 month in a nursing home. So $13,000 into $100,000 is basically close to 8 months. We pay for 8 months. We've got $100,000. We have Social Security and pension coming in. We break even. And in any event, you're allowed to keep $30,000. And again, you can prepay your funeral. You can do something with your house. You can buy a car. There's always something we can do. And I would say most of the time, if somebody had $500,000, worst case, we're going to end up spending maybe $100,000, $150,000 on nursing home bills. It's never too late to do something. We can always do something. But if that stroke happens, you go to a nursing home, we've got to act. The sooner we act, the better. Every month you sit by and do nothing, we're losing $13,000 a month. Now, I'm talking the formulas if you live in New York City. If you live in a more rural place in New York, we may not be able to do giveaway as much, but at the same time, the nursing home bill is not going to be as much. So it's all relative. And again, I'm talking to New York State residents right now. Jersey is different. Connecticut's different. Pennsylvania's different. We're talking about New York State Medicaid. The rules are the same no matter where you are in the state. They're interpreted slightly different whether you're in the city or outside the city, but the law is basically the same. Did I miss anything, Gladys? Or
I think that was a great explanation.
Okay. I know I went too fast, and you know, some of you out there taking on faith, if something happens, that's why we want a good power of attorney when we start our basic estate planning. And again, you got to give a power of attorney to the wrong person. You got to give a power of attorney to the person you trust. You give it to the wrong person, they can wipe you out, steal you blind under these circumstances. So you want to give a power of attorney to a family member that you can trust. They don't have to be the most brilliant member of your family. They have to be a member of your family who's honest and who's going to do the right thing and hopefully get the right advice. And if you have an honest relative, and I think most of you do, if you have an honest relative who's got a good heart and is going to do the right thing, I would strongly recommend you think about doing a power of attorney, because you never know what's going to happen. And some people don't realize, let's say you got a husband and wife, they think, well, I can automatically sign my spouse's name. That's not true. Let's say we're talking about the house. Let's say the deed reads John Smith and Mary Smith as wife. Husband goes to a nursing home. Wife wants to sell the house. Well, she can't sell the house without her husband's signature. There's no automatic right between husband and wife to sign each other's name. If she doesn't have a power of attorney, she can't sell the house. If the husband, as a result of that stroke we were talking about, is mentally incompetent, she can't sell the house without a court order. And then it's up to a judge to decide what's right. And if it's a second marriage, or even if the kids don't get along and there's controversy, you never know, there might be an independent guardian appointed in this case where you have to go to court and ask permission for every little thing, and you may not get it. The wife may not be able to sell her own house. And I know it sounds horrible, but that's the truth. And that's why if you're in one of those situations, and if you're in any situation, if you have a family member you can trust, you want to sign a power of attorney. If you don't have a family member you can trust, you got to be very careful about signing a power of attorney, because, again, you never know. You know, a person can, you know, steal you blind if in the right situation. You're going to a nursing home. You can't keep track of things yourself. And believe me, I've seen it. So you do have to be careful. Sometimes people think, say, oh, everybody should have a power of attorney. Well, yes and no. If you have a relative you can trust implicitly, has a good heart, is honest, then do a power of attorney. Because for the most part, I would think your relatives are going to do a better job taking care of your interests than a court-appointed lawyer.
And we've actually seen people who have come back because they want to remove people off their power of attorney. So you have to be aware of, you know, even if you do appoint somebody, are they misappropriating your funds and all that, and how, you know, what's next? What do you do next?
Occasionally happens. Sometimes you have a legitimate difference of opinion and you want to fire your power of attorney. That's fine. You can fire your power of attorney. Sometimes people think, well, you know, if I give power of attorney to my son, he's got control over me. No, he does not have control over you. If you give a power of attorney to your son and your son does something that you don't like, you can fire your son as power of attorney. If you got a son and daughter, you put both of them down if you want. If one of them does something you're not too crazy about, you fire one and go with the other. If you have two children, and both of them do something that you're not too crazy about, again, you can fire them and go with the nephew or niece. When you give somebody power of attorney, you're saying you can sign my name to certain documents, but you're not giving away your power. You can fire them. And yes, they may do some damage before you fire them, so that's a question. Do you really trust your relatives? And if there's borderline cases, we can do a power of attorney. It's called a springing power of attorney, where you sign a power of attorney, but nobody can use it until a medical doctor or a psychiatrist, or depending on what you put down, certifies in writing that you're not able to handle your affairs in a competent manner. And that way we can put a restriction so nobody can use the power of attorney unless a medical doctor says, in effect, you can't handle your own affairs. Now, you got to be careful what you wish for, because sometimes some doctors are not willing to sign the statements, and you could be in limbo a long time, especially, let's say, you have a husband and wife. Like the example you gave at the beginning, they're both in the nursing home at the same time, and the power of attorney says you need a medical doctor. Well, then what happens is you get a medical doctor, and then somebody says, well, the husband's the power of attorney, you're not power of attorney, you're alternate. And then sometimes you get in these catch-22s where you get ping-pong back and forth between different bureaucrats. So you got to be careful what you're wishing for. If you have children you can trust, my suggestion to you is you have your spouse on your power of attorney, and then if you have children you can trust, put those children that you can trust on your power of attorney, because you don't want to be caught in a position where you're, you know, absolutely frozen in life. Any other comments, Gladys?
Yeah, I'd also like to say that power of attorney is really a precautionary measure. A lot of people wait, you know, when something happens, and then people start to scramble. And it's always better to do it in advance, because you don't want to be put in a situation where you have to petition for guardianship. It takes a long time. It's, you know, the courts are slow. They really scrutinize everything. So having a power of attorney is really a great thing to have.
All right. So if you want to schedule an appointment with us at Connors and Sullivan, please feel free. Give us a call at 718-238-6500. 718-238-6500. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes.
How can I protect my family if something happens to me?
What if I need to go to a nursing home? What will happen to our savings, our home? What's the best way to give my home to my kids?
Who will help us take care of Grandpa?
These and many other questions can be answered with a phone call to Connors and Sullivan Attorneys at Law, PLLC, 718-238-6500. Mike Connors, one of New York Magazine's top lawyers, has over 30 years of estate planning and elder law experience. Mike and his team of professionals will help you protect your assets from probate, taxes, and nursing home costs, so you can have peace of mind knowing you and your family will be taken care of and protected.
I'm Mike Connors, founder of Connors and Sullivan. People don't plan to fail, they fail to plan. The time to plan is now.
I'm Beth Connors. Call today for a free initial consultation with one of our experienced lawyers.
Connors and Sullivan in Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, and Staten Island. Call 718-238-6500. 718-238-6500 or ConnorsandSullivan.com.
If you're a homeowner age 62 or older and are finding it harder to pay off debt, or how about enjoying your retirement years with less stress? A home equity conversion mortgage may be the answer for you and your family. Hi, this is Frank Melia, a certified mortgage planner, and I've helped countless homeowners all over the tri-state area tap into a little or a lot of their home equity so they can use it right now. Give me a call so our team here at Contour Mortgage can show you how the loan program works and how much you and your family may qualify for. My job is to help you find the best solution for your retirement goals. I do this by educating homeowners with straightforward information and answers. It's free to call and speak with me, Frank Melia, to determine if this mortgage program might be able to help you and your loved ones now. Call and speak with me. I'll answer your questions and help you decide if a reverse mortgage is right for you and your family. Make the call now, 888-954-7463. Once again, that's 888-954-7463, and you could be on your way to a better retirement. Frank Melia, NMLS number 62591, Contour Mortgage Corporation, NMLS number 34384, 990 Stewart Avenue, Suite 660, Garden City, New York, 11530, licensed mortgage banker, New York State Department of Financial Services.
I'm in a good place in my life.
And I'm energized by new adventures.
I've got friends to laugh with.
And a good relationship.
But even though I'm kind of comfortable,
I sometimes wonder, is there something more?
Could God and church be what you're looking for? Come and see at CatholicsComeHome.com.
Time now for Connor's Corner, where Mike takes a closer look at topics like history, politics, religion, and more. Here's Mike.
Welcome to the Connor's Corner segment of Ask the Lawyer. Our next guest is, to put it mildly, a prolific author. And a few years back, he was on our show, and I probably got more comments about his testimonial about his life than any other. Of course, we do have a lot of Irish Catholic listeners out there, and also some people from Scotland and England. And this, our next guest is Joe Pierce, and his testimonial was Race with the Devil. Welcome back to Connor's Corner, Joe.
It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so tell the audience something about your life, because I you know, the last time you talked about it, I think it was more than 5 years ago. So what was your background? Where'd you grow up? And what was your early life spent like?
Okay, so yes, you know, although I've been living in the United States, in South Carolina, to be precise, at the moment, since 2001, I'm a native-born Englishman. I was born on the edge of London at the beginning of the 1960s. At the age of 15, I became very heavily involved in radical politics, to be specific, with a white supremacist organization known as the National Front, which enjoyed a period of considerable popularity during the 1970s in particular. So I joined as a 15-year-old in 1976, and very quickly rose through the ranks. I was the youngest ever member of its governing body when I was about 17, I think. I started working full-time for the organization when I was 17 also, actually 17. I edited two magazines, for one of which, a magazine called Bulldog, I was sentenced to prison twice under Britain's hate crimes, the Race Relations Act, for publishing material deemed likely to incite racial hatred. So I spent my 21st and 25th birthdays in prison, serving a 6-month and a 12-month sentence, respectively.
Now, back then, what did you believe in?
Well, basically, you know, my father sort of raised me to believe that being English was basically about the best thing you can be. In fact, he used to say to me, I mean, partly jokingly, but nonetheless, I think with a degree of seriousness, he said there were only three types of people in the world. He said there were those who were Englishmen, those who would like to be Englishmen, and those who don't know any better. So that was the creed, if you like, which we grew up. We were not a religious family. We never went to church, except for weddings and funerals. We never prayed. Basically, England, in many respects, was my substitute, my surrogate religion. So, you know, I was very angry with the amount of immigration going on in the country in the 1970s. And my particular area of London there's a lot large influx, particularly of people from the Indian subcontinent, Pakistan, and also Sikhs from India, Muslims. So I was very angry, and as a hot-headed, angry 15-year-old, went to the extreme and joined this white supremacist. I think it would be fair to call it a neo-Nazi organization. Certainly, the leaders, myself including, including the early days. Were Nazis on the quiet. Publicly, we were not, but privately, we were.
And, you know, again, for our listeners, we have an audience out there that's, I would dare say, fairly conservative, largely Catholic, somewhat evangelical Christian. What were your beliefs about Catholics?
Well, I'm very anti-Catholic as well, I should say, as well as learning my racism at my father's knee. I also learned my anti-Catholicism at my father's knee. My dad used to call Catholics bead rattlers, and he came home from the pub one night. And I should explain, by the way, as a preamble to this, that my mother's mother, so my maternal grandmother, was Irish. She was a Kavanagh from County Galway, moved to England when she was a teenager. married a Welsh Protestant who was very anti-Catholic and refused to allow the children to be brought up as Catholics. But when my grandmother died, my mother kept her rosary beads as a keepsake. Now, my mother would have no idea how to say the rosary and no inclination to desire to do so, but I guess as a nostalgic keepsake of her own mother, she took her rosary beads when her mother died. But my father came back from the pub and said, "We're not having those papist beads in the house," and he threw them out the window. So again, being a hot-headed young man, I also took this anti-Catholicism to an extreme and got involved with the terrorist anti-Catholic organizations in Northern Ireland. And at that time in the 1970s, your older listeners will know there was a civil war going on in the north of Ireland between the Catholic tribe and the Protestant tribe. I say tribe because, you know, I consider myself to be a Protestant tribally. I wasn't a Christian particularly. I never went to church, but I was anti-Catholic and a Protestant in terms of tribal affiliation. And so I got involved with the terrorist organization as the UDA at the UVF in Northern Ireland, and also joined a secret society, an anti-Catholic secret society called the Orange Order. So I was very, very anti-Catholic.
Right. So you spent your 21st birthday in prison. What were you arrested for? What were you convicted of?
Well, I edited a magazine called Bulldog. It was the newspaper of the Young National Front. I was chairman of the Young National Front, which was the youth movement of the NF. And I edited that newspaper, and it was designed to stir up racial tension. We had the same philosophy as the Trotskyites, in fact, except they believed in class war and we believed in race war. We didn't believe that the revolution would happen through democracy. We believed the revolution would happen by destabilizing society. So whereas the Trotskyites sought to bring about a class war and a revolution through strikes and other industrial upheaval, we strove to do the same thing through trying to destroy the multiracial society by raising racial tensions and provoking racial violence. So that was part of the strategy, and as editor of the Bulldog, the newspaper, that was what I was endeavouring to do, and that was against the law and the Prisoners Race Relations Act, to publishing material deemed likely to incite racial hatred. And so I was charged under that act and was sentenced to 6 months in prison when I was 20 years old.
So let me ask you something, because I think Americans have, you know, I don't think they have a very good understanding about freedom of speech and freedom of the press as it relates to other countries where you don't have a constitution. So in other words, you were jailed for writing articles.
Absolutely. And again, this is a very tricky subject, but, you know, that once you start allowing so-called hate crimes, then it's not long. You find that, you know, you're a lawyer, I'm not, but, you know, the principle of hard cases make bad law. So you find an extremist no one's going to defend, such as me when I was a young man, and you pass the Race Relations Act, making it illegal to stir up racial hatred. Well, who's in favour of stirring up racial hatred? Nobody. So who's going to argue with that? But then you've got a hate crime on the statute book. So before you know it, people are being charged with, but because they have a traditional Christian view of morality, for instance, or they're opposed to abortion, for instance, and that's now happening throughout Europe because this hate law was allowed to be passed. So I don't believe that the Race Relations Act was a good law, but nor do I think that what I was publishing was a good thing. I don't think that I should have been able to go to prison for editing a newspaper because of as I said, what you're doing is opening a can of worms there, which is going to undermine free speech, not just for the lunatic fringe, but for the mainstream. So, but, you know, that was the situation. And I suppose by provoking them into prosecuting me, I sort of opened the floodgates for hate laws, I suppose, up to a point.
All right. So you said you spent your 21st birthday in jail and your 25th birthday in jail. What happened at the time around your 25th birthday? What were you arrested for again?
Yeah, so basically it was exactly the same offense. So when I got out of prison, I wasn't going to be bullied out of editing Bulldog. On the other hand, I didn't want to go straight back to prison again, and I wasn't prepared to tone down the content. So the Bulldog was edited by Captain Truth. So in other words, with a degree of anonymity, but that just provoked the British establishment into authorizing a raid on my home in the middle of the night, in which all the necessary evidence was found to link me with the editing of the magazine still. And I was charged a second time with publishing material like this, like racial hatred, for editing the same magazine. And as it's a second offence, the sentence was more serious. I got 12 months instead of 6 months. But the difference is that whereas at the beginning of the first sentence, I consider myself to be a revolutionary, a political soldier who's prepared to die for the cause, and I treated my cell as a gym. I used my bed as a bench press to get myself in physical shape to come out and be a better political soldier and revolutionary before. But beginning of the second sentence, I was thinking to myself, what on earth am I doing here? I don't even believe this stuff anymore. And that was largely due to the fact that I've begun reading people such as G.K. Chesterton, the Catholic writer. We could talk about that at more length. But I would like to say that second day of that 12-month prison sentence, I find myself holding some rosary beads in my hand. Now, and again, apart from obviously my dad throwing the rosary beads out the window and calling Catholic bead rattlers, in my involvement in Northern Ireland, in the terrorism of Northern Ireland with the UDN UVF, we used to sing a song, to the tune of Home on the Range, which I'll sing a refrain of it because it indicates the rosary which I'm talking about. So it began, no Pope of Rome, no chapels to sadden my eyes, no nuns and no priests, no rosary beads. Every day is the 12th of July. So the 12th of July is a Protestant feast day celebration in Northern Ireland. But yes, yeah, so no nuns and no priests, no rosary beads. But now I find myself holding these rosary beads, and I have no idea how I got them, but I'm holding them, taking them to a prison sentence, and I have a great desire to say the rosary. And at this point, I've never prayed in my life. I'm 24 years old, and I have this great desire to pray the rosary, but I didn't know the Hail Mary, I didn't know the Glory Be, I didn't know the Apostles' Creed, and I had been taught the Our Father when I was a small child, but had forgotten it. So obviously I couldn't pray the rosary per se, but what I did do was to fumble the beads and mumble inarticulate prayers. And that was the beginning of my relationship with Christ, and answers began to flood in. Healing began to happen, and I started to attend Mass during that second prison sentence.
Well, let me ask you, so what, you know, it just wasn't the set of the rosary beads in your cell. What was leading you toward conversion?
Well, as I said, I was obviously not interested in religion. I wasn't interested in Christianity, and I was opposed to very anti-Catholic. But I was interested, obviously, in politics and economics. We used to get in fights in the street with the extreme left, with the Marxists, and they would taunt us with, you're just the stormtroopers of capitalism. And my view was that although I was opposed to communism, I didn't want the world run by global corporations, by the World Bank, by the International Monetary Fund, and by whoever the 1980s equivalent of Bill Gates and George Soros was. So, you know, I thought I just don't take this approach to politics. You either have to be a Marxist or an apologist for global corporate capitalism. So I was looking for alternatives. And someone said, well, have you looked at the political ideas of G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc? And I hadn't, but I was interested. So I started reading Chesterton and Belloc for their political ideas, but very quickly found myself being sympathetic with their philosophy. And then, you know, realized that their philosophy was a consequence of their theology. So, you know, bit by bit, I found myself getting more and more attracted to Catholicism without even realizing it at first. And then by the time I did realize it, it's about a bit like the frog being boiled alive slowly. You know, by the time I did realize that I was getting hooked by Catholicism, I was quite happy to be hooked.
Speaking about Chesterton, you know, I think some of the people out there might think that he just wrote some harmless Father Brown stories, which are recycled on, you know, American television right now. Who was Chesterton?
Yes, yeah, so G.K. Chesterton was a convert of the faith and one of the major literary figures of the first third of the 20th century. So he was first published in 1900, so at the turn of the century, and died in 1936. But he, you know, he and his friend Belloc were men of letters, which means they didn't just stick to one genre. You mentioned Father Brown, which is obviously short stories and detective fiction, but he wrote works of Catholic apologetics. He wrote works of history. He wrote biographies. He wrote works of philosophy. His book, The Everlasting Man, for instance, which was a Catholic philosophy of history, basically, was very instrumental in the conversion of C.S. Lewis to Christianity, and was a major work. So, you know, he was probably, I talk about the Catholic cultural revival in the English-speaking world, and that really begins with the conversion of St. John Henry Newman in 1845, and that period in the 19th century is the Newman period. But the second period of that Catholic cultural revival, from 1900 to 1936, you know, Chesterton first being published to his death, is basically the period of the Chester Belloc, the period where G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc are the two giant figures presiding over the Catholic revival. So he was hugely significant, not just to me, but to English culture and to the Catholic revival. And when I wrote my book, Literary Converts, it was clear to me that Chesterton was probably responsible for more converts to the faith, certainly in the literary world, than anybody except perhaps Newman himself.
What accounts in your mind for the fact that there were so many prominent Englishmen that converted in the early 20th century? What was going on that led these people to conversion?
Yeah, well, I think basically, first of all, I think that the culture was in crisis. People were uncomfortable with the philosophical materialism and industrialism and imperialism of the British Empire. On the other hand, they were not happy with socialism. So the Catholic Church, through encyclicals such as Rerum Novarum, Pope Leo XIII encyclical from 1891, gave a viable and, quite frankly, rational and sane alternative to the madness of either philosophical materialism, political materialism, and also that political materialism, whether it's in its globalist capitalist form or whether it's in its globalist socialist form, that the Catholic Church's social teaching offers a viable alternative. And I think that was actually seen by many people as the sane and a rational way forward in the first third of the 20th century. When I was doing my research for Literary Converts, I noted that there were tens of thousands of adult converts to the faith in England alone between the two world wars.
That's interesting. I mean, you know a little bit about it, but not that much. Hey, you got to tell the listeners, what happened to your life after the second jail term?
Well, I knew obviously that I needed to make a break from my life, literally, because what you have to understand is one of the reasons I was still sort of living the lie up to that second prison sentence was that within the nationalist movement, I was a hero and a martyr, having gone to prison twice. Outside, because the court case has got national headlines, I was a pariah. So, you know, what I knew that when I got out of prison, I had to basically bite the bullet, say goodbye to all my comrades, physically move from London to a backwater in England, to Norfolk, and to cross a threshold from a place where I'm idolized as a hero to a place where I'm demonized as a pariah. And then that's what I did after I got out of prison the second time. And a couple of years after that, I was received into the Catholic Church. And hence a whole new life began. I wrote my biography of G.K. Chesterton as an act of thanksgiving, both to God for giving me Chesterton, but also to Chesterton for giving me God, so to speak. And when that was published by a major publisher in the UK, I became a full-time writer, and the rest is history. And now, almost 30 years after that, I have over 30 books published, and obviously that brought me to the United States and the teaching and speaking that I'm currently doing over here.
Okay, well, your personal life, what happened?
Well, I met a young lady who's from Southern California. There's actually a story behind that, actually, as well, because, you know, I adopted a name when I started writing as a Catholic. I adopted a nom de plume, because a pseudonym, because of my own name, that Joe Pearce was such a byword for racism in England. So I adopted the name Robert Williamson, and I did that from an Orange song, so from an anti-Catholic song we used to sing, which basically is about an Orange man, so a Protestant bigot, basically, from this secret society, who marries a Catholic called Bridget McGinn. And he lived in a small place in the County Tyrone near the town of Dungannon in the north of Ireland. And this lady I met in Oxford was actually from Southern California, but her mother was from the County Tyrone near the town of Dungannon, from a small village called The Rock. So, you know, I see this as a providential coincidence that, you know, having chosen the name Robert Williamson, then as if God sort of liked the joke. It gets me to meet the daughter of someone born in that exact same area of Northern Ireland.
Now, where are you today?
Just to carry on from that, I subsequently married that young lady. We moved to the States. She moved to England when we first got married, but just for a few months. Then I was offered a job at Ave Maria University. Moved over here just 4 days before 9/11, so September the 7th, 2001. And we've been living here since and raising a family, and now we're living in the upstate of South Carolina, and that basically brings the story up to date.
All right, now let me ask you something. The book we were talking about, your autobiography book, Race with the Devil, where can somebody find that? Do you have a website?
Yeah, I do, actually. So the one-stop place for everything that I'm doing, writing, for if people want to find out where to buy my books, is my personal website, which is jpearce.co, so that's jpearce.co. If they go there, they'll see a book section on the website, and they can find the book there and purchase it from there.
All right. Do you have any advice to people right now in Europe and Canada and so forth? What should they be doing to protect free speech? You know, because, again, the slippery slope is there, as you were just mentioning. I'm very disturbed at what I hear from Canada. Do you have any comments?
Yeah, basically, you know, the freedom has to be fought for, and I think the danger is that most of us prefer comfort to freedom, so we're in danger of somnambulating towards slavery because we were not prepared to make the necessary sacrifices to preserve freedom. But we certainly need to do that, and the way we need to do that is to be part of the growth of localism, to be standing against the tyranny of globalism and this one-size-fits-all ideology of wokeism, which basically refuses to acknowledge any dissident opinion. So, yeah, if we value freedom, and I wrote a book also, a biography of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and you know, he's an inspiration for the way that he stood up for freedom and free speech during the tyranny of the Soviet Union. There are lessons we can learn from his life and from the sacrifice he made and the success he had in helping to overthrow tyranny. And with him, look at the example of other courageous people that fought against tyranny, such as John Paul II. And these are the people we need to be inspired by and to emulate, to have the courage to stand up for freedom and free speech. You know, otherwise we'll find ourselves living under a tyranny and have to fight for our freedom in much worse situation than we are at the present.
All right, again, do me a favor, give me your website one more time.
Yeah, so the personal website, again, if people want to check out the Solzhenitsyn book I just mentioned, same place, jpearce.co, jpearce.co.
Joseph, thank you very much for spending time with us on Connor's Corner.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Tape over.
How can I protect my family if something happens to me?
What if I need to go to a nursing home? What will happen to our savings, our home? What's the best way to give my home to my kids?
Who will help us take care of Grandpa?
These and many other questions can be answered with a phone call to Connors & Sullivan Attorneys at Law, PLLC, 718-238-6500. Mike Connors, one of New York Magazine's top lawyers, has over 30 years of estate planning and elder law experience. Mike and his team of professionals will help you protect your assets from probate, taxes, and nursing home costs so you can have peace of mind knowing you and your family will be taken care of and protected.
I'm Mike Connors, founder of Connors & Sullivan. People don't plan to fail, they fail to plan. The time to plan is now. now.
I'm Beth Connors. Call today for a free initial consultation with one of our experienced lawyers.
Connors and Sullivan in Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, and Staten Island. Call 718-238-6500, 718-238-6500, or connorsandsullivan.com.
I'm in a good place in my life.
And I'm energized by new adventures.
I've got friends to laugh with.
And a good relationship.
But even though I'm kind of comfortable,
I sometimes wonder, is there something more?
Could God and church be what you're looking for? Come and see at CatholicsComeHome.com.
Do you have somewhere to sleep? Did you eat today? Are you making ends meet? For thousands of New Yorkers, the answer is no. For children and youth, adults, seniors, people struggling with addiction or mental illness, and for the isolated, Catholic Charities of Brooklyn and Queens is there. With 160 programs and more than 4,500 units of affordable housing, Catholic Charities is one of the largest multi-service charitable organizations in the nation. We help change lives and build communities. If you or someone you know needs assistance, call 718-722-6001 or visit ccbq.org.
Do you know how many Christians live in the Middle East? 6 million people. Do you know how many Christians need your help? Every single one. Do you know what we can do? With St. Francis in Beirut, we can give them hope. We can give them medicines. We can give them medical equipment. We can give them everything they're looking for. Because some others decided to remove Christianity from the Middle East. But if we will help them every single day, not just to feed them or clothing, it's all about giving them another day with the idea that they are recognized, that we love them, they're our cousins, sisters, they're our roots. So St. Francis in Beirut, it's all about helping Christians. And you can be part of that help too.
If you want to help Father Paul in his mission, send your donations to St. Francis in Beirut, 213 Stanton Street, New York, New York, 10002.
Welcome back to Ask the Lawyer with me, Mike Connors, now accompanied by my wife, Beth.
Hi, everybody.
And my son, Michael.
Hello, everyone.
Otto's in the room, too, for those who care.
Hey.
All right, so thanks again to Joe Pierce. We're going to have him again next week because we're going to talk about one of his books, 12 Great Books. And he said not the 12 greatest books, but 12 great books. So, I'll find it interesting. I hope you guys out there do, too. But if we want to get back to estate planning and elder law, we're going to be doing seminars at the end of April. So, Beth, you want to give us the time and places?
Here we go. Wednesday, April 24th, 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. will be at Connolly's Corner, 7115 Grand Avenue in Queens.
Massbeth, Queens.
Massbeth. And then Thursday, April 25th, we have 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. Don Roberto's Classic Italian, 616 Forest Avenue, Staten Island. Then Friday, April 26th, 11 a.m. and 3 p.m., the Adria Hotel in Bayside, 221-17 Northern Boulevard, Bayside. Now, Monday, April 29th, we have 3 p.m. and 7 p.m., Greenhouse Cafe, 7717 3rd Avenue in Brooklyn, Bay Ridge. Then Tuesday, which is our last time for this group, Tuesday, April 30th, 11 a.m. and 3 p.m., Buckley's Restaurant, and that's 2926 Avenue S, Brooklyn, New York.
All right. Now, if you want to attend any one of our seminars, give us a call at 718-238-6500, 718-238-6500. Now, the attendance is free, but we do like to know how many people are going to show up so we can set up the room properly. And a part of the seminar is, you know, the question and answer period. Ordinarily, we stick around and answer as many questions as come from the floor. If at the end you want to ask me a question semi-private, you know, obviously in the seminar room or whatever, it's not going to be complete privacy, But if you want to ask me a question and send me private, please feel free to do so. You can wait to the end. There's usually going to be one of the other attorneys in our office at each one of the meetings. So if the crowd gets a little big as far as answering questions, we can break off. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with me or one of the other attorneys, we'll have our schedulers there. And you can schedule an appointment with us at any one of our offices, whether it's Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, or Manhattan. We don't charge for the initial consultation. The initial consultation is free on anything that we're talking about as far as estate planning goes. And the idea behind estate planning, we mention this every week, the idea behind estate planning is to pass assets from one generation to the next, paying the least amount in taxes we need to pay legally, avoiding going through court, avoiding probate, and as far as elder law is concerned, trying to save assets from nursing home bills. And I can tell you right now, one of the main focuses of most of people's questions, how do I get my house to my kids? How do I save my house from a nursing home? And again, the answer we give you is to try to optimize on taxes. Not, we don't want your children to have to pay taxes. We don't want to lose your house to a nursing home bill. We want to protect your house because the house in many of our families, that's the most important asset that we have, our house. And we want to leave our house for our family so they can use it for their retirement. Maybe they're going to live in it, whatever reason. But we want to save that house from family. Now, other assets, yes, we want to save them too. But I think the main focus of the seminars when you hear the questions at the end is what do I do with my house? And, you know, we're going to try to give you the best plan available. You give us an idea of what your financial situation is, what your family situation is, and we'll give you a plan based on those factors. And, you know, give us your facts. We'll give you a plan. Everything we do as far as estate planning and elder law is on a flat fee basis. We don't charge by the hour on those things. We charge by the job. So come in, we'll talk it over, and we go from there. So again, if you want to attend one of our seminars, give us a call at 718-238-6500. We're running out of time for this week's show. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back same time next week, same places.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Voices raised, heads bowed down. We're gathered here on hallowed ground to sing this soul away.
We are gathered here
on hallowed ground. Voices raised, heads bowed down. We're gathered here on hallowed ground to sing this soul away.
Hi, Kevin McCullough. Are you or your parents' assets protected from nursing home bills? Did you know these bills can exceed $15,000 a month? People work their entire lives to live comfortably in retirement, but when people become ill and need to go to a nursing home or receive home care, the bills can drain their assets, leaving many people bankrupt. The good news is that you can prevent that from happening if you plan in advance. Connors and Sullivan's lawyers can customize a plan that specifically protects your interests, including your home. Schedule a free comprehensive telephone consultation with Mike Connors to discuss your issues and concerns from the security of your home. Call today, 718-238-6500, 718-238-6500. Don't let nursing home bills take your life's savings and leave you and your loved ones bankrupt. Don't wait another minute. Mike Connors can take you through the process by telephone and start a plan designed for you today. That's 718-238-6500. 718-238-6500.
The preceding pre-recorded program paid for by Connors and Sullivan Attorneys at Law, PLLC.